fourth case, Neary versus Ross Tuzzi.
My name is George Goyke. I was counsel for the debtors in the bankruptcy court, in the district court, and now on the appeal. About 3 years ago, Congress passed bankruptcy reform legislation. Among the things they did is they divided the world into rich and poor using median income as the dividing line. If you earn over median income in your state, you're considered one of the rich, and you have to go through the means testing. Okay? The Tausis were over the median income, so we had to go through the means testing. The means testing has a form that was promulgated. It's Form B-22. It's Appendix 2 to my brief. The means test gives you a series of allowances that you take for food, for clothing, for transportation expense in terms of operating the vehicles, and also a series of deductions that you're allowed. Example, if you owned a cabin cruiser that you moored on Lake Michigan, you'd be able to take that as a deduction out of your income.
What happens to the responsible debtor who has sold her car to pay off her debts, but who is likely to need a car at some point, you know, in the future to commute to a job, that would help her get back on her feet? Why shouldn't she get the deduction, too? Or is it your position that she should?
My position is that she should. If she owns a car, she gets the deduction. If she doesn't own a car, there's another expense allowance. There's a public transportation expense allowance.
Well, this one sold her car.
Okay. If there were someone that sold the car, the way the statute is written is, she doesn't get the deduction at all.
But you think she should?
I think she should.
Okay.
Because it, certainly in rural Wisconsin, there is no public transportation available. So we've got this series of allowances, a series of subtractions that you're able to take under the means test. Among the subtractions is an ownership allowance for a vehicle. In this case, the debtors actually owned six vehicles, and the testimony was that any two of them might work at a given time. None of them was very valuable. And we selected the ownership allowance under the means test because the means test statute says so. We're looking at 11 U.S.C. Section 707 B2. It talks about the debtor's monthly expenses shall be. Okay, so Congress is telling us that you have to take these particular expenses. It shall be the debtor's applicable monthly expense amounts under the national standards and local standards. Okay, what are the national standards and local standards? We've got a food, clothing, and personal care entry that's under the national standards. At the time, that was based upon income. Rich people must have have steak and poor people hamburger under the standards as they existed at the time. That has now changed. And family size.
Yes, before we change to mashed potatoes for poor and hamburger for rich.
Basically, yes.
And before you get to those standards, can we just spend a moment on your interpretation of applicable? Because that's a critical word in there. And doesn't allowing debtors to claim a standard vehicle expense amount only when they have a loan or lease expense give meaning to the word applicable?
Applicable is in that statute not just looking at vehicles. It's looking at the operating expense of vehicles. It's looking at this food expense. Applicable means selecting the proper category out of these national and local standards.
And you're saying once that category is there, then it's mandatory.
Correct. On transportation expense, for example, Chicago is a higher expense allowance for transportation than Wisconsin. It just is. It costs more for me to fill my gas tank here than it did at home. Multiple use of that word applicable.
Right, because there are other meanings you agree to applicable. Sometimes applicable can mean does it apply to you?
Correct.
And so if you don't have a car, it wouldn't apply to you.
And obviously the case law, I'm sorry, I cut
you
off. With the case law that's out there, it's split. There's learned judges on both sides of how this word applicable pans out. And each of the judges obviously felt they had compelling reasons to think that their interpretation was correct. But if you look at the big scheme of things, that's a multiple-use word. It's not just looking at vehicles. I mean, if we're using the government's theory of the meaning of the word applicable, then the food allowance would only be applicable if you purchased steak and not hamburger or something to that effect. And these are used in bankruptcy, and the way that it's written here isn't the way it's used in the IRS code when the IRS is determining whether or not to give somebody an offer in compromise to pay less than the full amount of their taxes.
Of course, the trustee says that a debtor with only a few or single monthly payments remaining will still face dismissal under 707B3B based on a totality of the circumstances. Doesn't that take care of one of the perceived inequities that you have cited?
That then you don't have the presumption that someone is abusing bankruptcy. The burden of proof reverses under 707B3, where the government has to prove that this bankruptcy filing is abusive. And under those sorts of circumstances, we're giving discretion back to bankruptcy judges. We're not just applying a formulaic statute. And in that discretion, the judge can determine that in this circumstance, even though that car only has three payments left, it needs new tires, the engine's breaking down, it's going to need to be replaced anytime soon, and you could budget for the replacement of that vehicle, probably at somewhere in the neighborhood of the ownership allowance that is given by the IRS. Currently, that's $489 monthly. For vehicle one and vehicle two. At the time, it was a lesser dollar amount at that.
Can you spend some time on the jurisdictional issue? Because what would be left for the bankruptcy court to do? Would it really be ministerial? Because doesn't the court still have to decide whether to dismiss the case or allow a conversion to a Chapter 13 proceeding? And do you think that decision would make it a ministerial? Would that be ministerial in your view? Having to decide whether to dismiss the case or allow a conversion to a Chapter 13?
Yes.
And you think that's ministerial?
I think that's the debtor's discretion, not the court's. In this case, if the means test disallowed those vehicle exemptions and we didn't take the $200 that the trustee is urging is allowed there, that would leave these debtors about $500 left over under the means test that they'd have to contribute to a Chapter 13 plan over 60 months. That means that they'd be obligated to continue to pay about $30,000 in Chapter 13. They wouldn't be able to. If this case were dismissed in Chapter 7, they wouldn't have a pending matter for this court to hear. It would be a done deal. There would be no more jurisdiction because the bankruptcy court would have dismissed the case. And they would be subject at that time to the pursuit of creditors if they were out of bankruptcy, and they could have their resources garnished and not be able to send a lawyer to Chicago for them. So I think it's telling in the statute, too, that they distinguish between the word applicable when you're talking about the national and local standards and the word actual when we're talking about other necessary expenses, for example, medical expenses. At the time, for a medical expense, you would claim a deduction for what you're paying out of pocket that insurance doesn't cover for your deductible, your copay, your prescription drugs, your eye care, your dental care, your over-the-counter remedies. And those would just be claimed, and you'd have to substantiate those. There's a difference there where there's a inspection of those actual expenses in the same sentence compared to the applicable expenses that you're drawing from this IRS chart. And again, the chart is very much determined by the category that you're talking about. The vehicle operating expense is varied by a region of the nation in which you live. The heating expense also varies. I think Southern Florida would be very different than Wisconsin in terms of your utility expense allowances. So that's the gist of my opening. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Garkey. Mr. Setko?
Thank you, Your Honor. With your permission, I'd like to start by giving you a brief update on the status of this issue before the United States Courts of Appeals. It's pending before this court as well as the United States Courts of Appeals for the 6th, the 8th, the 9th, and the 10th Circuit. This is the first court that has entertained argument on the issue, and to the extent that you reach the merits in this case, it will provide significant guidance, I think, both to the department and to others.
Forgive me, did you end with the 8th?
No, Your Honor. It's the 6th, the 8th, the 9th, and the 10th.
Wait, I'm sorry. The 6th?
The 8th, the 9th, and the 10th.
My understanding was that the 8th and 3rd circuits have held that the denial of a motion to dismiss a Chapter 7 is final.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. Some of these come up from orders dismissing cases. Some come up from orders denying dismissal of cases. The Ninth Circuit actually is under a direct appeal under a new statute, 158D2, which in certain circumstances allows direct appeals from bankruptcy courts to United States Courts of Appeals. But Sixth Circuit is Kimbrough, Eighth Circuit is Washburn, Tenth Circuit is Pearson, and the Ninth Circuit is Ransom, R-A-N-S-O-M. This is an issue of importance to the department because we have a unique statutory obligation. We are required in every case under the new statute to determine whether a presumption of abuse arises, and when it does, we must either institute a proceeding in which we ask that all of the debtor's debts be discharged because, will not be discharged, that none of the debts will be discharged because the case must be dismissed or if the debtor wishes to convert, or if we lose, they would all be discharged, or to file a pleading with the court declining to file such a proceeding. So we do welcome your guidance on this issue.
Let me just ask you a question, ask you the same question I put to opposing counsel. What's left for the bankruptcy court to do? Would you view it as being purely ministerial?
Yes.
Whether to dismiss it or to convert it to a Chapter 13?
Yes, Your Honor.
You view it as ministerial as well?
Yes, Your Honor. We most certainly do.
You know, one of your arguments in the brief is that the debtor's interpretation allows debtors to claim phantom expenses. But isn't this also true if the debtors have $5 per month car payments and yet still qualify, for the full $803 deduction? It seems as though you're really advocating for an actual expense deduction or an IRS-like deduction that allows debtors to take the standard deduction or the actual, whichever is less. So are you or am I just way off base?
Not at all, Your Honor. That's a different issue that's not presented in this case. The numbers that are used here, as you can tell from page 2 of the addendum to our brief, are numbers that the IRS obtained from the Federal Reserve Board. And the Federal Reserve Board determined what it typically costs to have an ownership expense for a car. And so that's what you're typically going to pay. First cars, people generally pay a little more than second cars. So if you have that expense, most likely it's not going to be $1 or $5. I've never heard of a lease that's $1 or $5, Your Honor. It's going to be roughly in that range. And the question in this case is, if you have no loan expense and no lease expense, Is the standardized expense amount, which is based upon Federal Reserve data, applicable to you? And the district court concluded it is not applicable to you under the plain meaning, under the better reading of that term for three reasons. First, because the text reads best as not making it applicable to you. Second, because that fulfills the express stated purpose behind the 2005 legislation, regardless of whether one is sympathetic to that legislation or unsympathetic to that legislation. And third, that result is fair to debtors and to creditors.
You know, another one of the your problems with the debtor's interpretation is that it would allow a higher-income debtor with an inoperable car to claim the ownership expense amount. And I'm not sure why that would be incorrect from a policy perspective, because
that's the debtor's position. I'm sorry, that would be the debtor's position, Your Honor.
If they
own a car, they can claim over $400 merely because it's there. As the district court said, under their view, if there's a rusting hulk sitting in a field that is a car, they would shield from their creditors over $400. And as we explain in our brief, one district court has said that interpretation basically boggles the imagination.
Well, but wouldn't it then allow the owner of that inoperable vehicle to sell it for scrap and purchase an operable vehicle? And then that would allow that person to commute to a job.
Yes, our interpretation doesn't affect that in any way, Your Honor. They're perfectly free to purchase vehicles. This is only a question of people make life choices. And let's look quickly at these debtors. These debtors have the good fortune to make about 125% of median income. They have no dependents. They have not chosen to use their money to purchase cars. They've not used their money to upkeep their house. Yet they have $65,000 in credit card bills. The only exceptional expense they have is that they have a timeshare at a second casino. They also work at a casino. So they have chosen to incur $65,000 of debts, not for cars, not for house repairs. And they have, under their current situation, the ability to make, under the means test, at least $240 a month in payments to that $65,000 in debt they chose to incur. And the question in the case is, if they don't have an ownership expense, why should they be allowed to claim a ownership expense amount when the statute requires that the amount be applicable? And there's no question about what was the goal of the 2005 Act. We provide cites in our brief. The Act was a monumental undertaking, and I think it's important. This is a redline version of the 2005 Act, and if you look at it, it's read everywhere. Every single page of the bankruptcy code was changed in 2005. It's not insignificant that when you go to the House report, the very first paragraph of the House report says that the heart of the 2005 administration was to pass the means test, which, as they note, through many votes in Congress, was bipartisan and bicameral. And that's also in the legislative history, which describes those overwhelming votes. Because debtors should make payments more than they were, and that there were subterfuges and mistakes in the law. And so Congress chose to pass a statute that requires that an expense amount be applicable to you, which under the dictionary definition means capable of being applied.
I have to say, I mean, this is a terrible, difficult case. It really is a difficult case. Because when you apply the language as you have urged, there seem to be certain sort of illogical consequences, like a debtor who has one more month of payments to make, he gets the full deduction. But a debtor who just completed payments gets nothing.
But there is an answer. I'm sorry. I can address that if you like, Your Honor. That's actually addressed.
I wanted to go through my whole list of horribles. But then you might not remember, so maybe you ought to. I mean, you know, a person who has no car payments to make likely has an older car and will need to buy a new car soon, yet gets no deduction. Savers get no allowance for the purchase of a new car. It seems to encourage debtors to finance the purchase of a new car or refinance prior to filing bankruptcy. It seems to punish debtors, you know, who choose to drive cheap cars that they own rather than borrow money to purchase more expensive, safer cars. I mean, there are just a lot of things. And I blame Congress because Congress could have included actual expenses for car payments, you know, but it chose to take the simpler route and take an average cost figure. And this is what happens when you estimate with averages.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, there certainly has been substantial debate about whether this was an appropriate policy choice. The text is the text that we have.
Yeah.
I would respectfully suggest that some of those things that seem that they're unfair are only unfair because bankruptcy is complicated. And if I might have a few minutes, I might be able to unwind some of those. Again, on page one of the legislative history, Congress makes clear that this means test is a screening mechanism. And the way it's almost like the analogy I use, it's like you're panning for gold. There are three filters in 707. And what this is meant to do is it's meant to knock out the cases that Congress thought were the most obviously abusive. If you have one payment left, as you noted in talking to Mr. Goyke, what would happen is your case would be dismissed under B3B because courts are required, when the totality of your financial circumstances show that you have an ability to repay, that your case would have to be dismissed. So when you look at the code as a whole, that works. Similarly, people make life choices. Some people choose to drive clunkers and spend their money elsewhere. What the attempt is here, and no one's claimed this is unconstitutional. I'm not aware of any case where anyone has suggested that the statute as applied denies them the minimum amount of credits to live so that it works. If it doesn't, we would have in a different case a constitutional challenge that we don't have here. So it does work. Debtors can go to Chapter 13. For example, if the Rastusis were to choose to go to Chapter 13 and they then wanted to buy a car, Section 1329 of the Bankruptcy Code would allow them to modify their Chapter 13 plan. They might start off paying $500, but then they would say, now we've purchased a car, so we cannot make monthly payments of $500 any longer. Please modify our Chapter 13 plan. That's fair to the Rastusis, and it is fair to the creditors. So long as at the present they have that ability to make those payments, Congress has made a policy choice. They should make those payments. There are a number of flexibilities, which I think is fortuitous. It's fortunate. I apologize. And so that is the statute we have. And the last point I would like to make is on the word applicable, if I might. As the district court noted, and as many other courts have noted, the Rastusis construction of that word renders it redundant because the statute says the debtor's monthly expenses shall be the debtor's applicable monthly expense amount specified under the standards. Well, if you took out the word applicable, it would say the debtor's monthly expenses shall be the debtor's applicable monthly expense amounts. You would still go to the standards. That word, no one says, they're suggesting that it says, when you go to the standards, don't go to the wrong number. And this is an incredibly simple set of standards. You can only claim one car or two cars. It's not like you have this complicated matrix that would fill that wall.
Well, I think that the debtor believes that applicable modifies amount specified.
Yes, yes.
And not monthly expense. And so, you know, the debtor has to choose which amount is applicable to the debtor based on.
But their suggestion is that it's much like saying, when I tell my son to go to school, I need to say, and by the way, be sure not to go the wrong way. I mean, they don't get, they give a meaning that any reasonable person would apply to this statute if the word applicable were struck out. It would still say that your monthly expense amount is that specified under the standards. So applicable cannot do the job, as the district court noted, cannot do the job the debtor's ascribed to it. And instead, it has to have a different definition. The one the district court gave is fair to debtors, it is fair to creditors, and it is consistent with the purpose of the 2005 legislation. And for that reason, we would respectfully ask this court to affirm the order of the district court.
I have a question. The debtors claim that you did not appeal the 707B3 determination, and so it can't be raised if we were to remand. What is your response to that?
We did, and my recollection is, Your Honor, although I apologize, I believe we also fully briefed it before the district court. The appeal order is not issues, as we know.
Uh-huh.
And so under 158B, 28 U.S.C. 158B, which is appeals from bankruptcy courts to district courts, we appealed the order. It was a unitary order disposing of both issues, both of which were litigated. The transcript discussion by the district court of the 707B3B is in the transcript excerpt that's in our appendix. And we appealed in the district court's order, which just found it unnecessary to address that issue because he reversed the bankruptcy court.
And then I had another question.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I'm sorry. In In Re Jartran, you know, our circuit determined that denials of motions to dismiss Chapter 11 petitions are generally not final, right?
Yes. What it said was generally, and that's at 886 Fed Second 864.
Right.
Those are generally not final.
Right. Why should a Chapter 7 be any different?
Well, this order, I'd like to take – this is an important point, and if you want an answer, with your permission, I'd like to take about 2 minutes, because this order is more final than Jartran or Vlasic, which is the other case, and this case is completely done, neither of which were true in either one of those cases. And I could go through that very quickly. It's not unusual in a Chapter 11 context to have five motions to dismiss. Someone will file a motion to dismiss, and the judge, generally because they say the plan cannot be reorganized, and the judge will say, you know, I'm just not sure, I want to wait 3 months, and then renew your motion. And I've seen appeals where it was the fifth motion. And if you go back to the Jartran facts, you'll notice that in the first Jartran bankruptcy, it was actually the third amendment of the fifth plan of confirmation that finally got confirmed. Those things just go on, and they're not final. Here, the deadlines have run. The issue about whether all these debtors' debts can be discharged or none of their debts can be discharged is finally adjudicated. And most significantly, there's just nothing left to do in this case. And you can determine that from the appendix we have in two places. Page 8 of our appendix, the debtors checked a box in which they said, in their view, there would be no assets to distribute. This is one of the 96% of Chapter 7 cases, historically, where creditors get zilch. And on page 3 of our appendix is docket item 14. In docket item 14, which was filed before we filed our motion, the private non-governmental trustee who administers this case said, there are no assets here, because they can claim as exemptions more than anything they would have to pay, which meant that there was no more adjudication. In contrast, in Vlasic, if you go to 325 Fed 3rd, 953 at 954, the order there was entered April 30th, 1999. It was not until 4 months later that a big dispute about properties was reached. On August 31st, the court ordered four properties to be sold, and that case litigated for 2 more years. The same thing in Jartran. It was a very complicated Chapter 11 that was just at the inception. Here, there are just 2 ministerial acts to be taken before the bankruptcy court, and this is over, and none of them will involve any substantive determination.
Thank you, Mr. Sutcliffe.
Thank you. You really helped me. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
As a first point, I'd like to agree with counsel for the United States trustee that I believe that this is a final hearing and there's nothing left to do except to either dismiss the case or if the debtors choose to convert, it would be their choice, not the court's. So there's nothing left for the court to do. I want to touch a little bit on the fairness of it all. Consider these debtors. They're driving beater cars. They're living in a $30,000 home, and even in Wisconsin, that doesn't buy a whole lot. They've chosen to live a minimalistic lifestyle. The fact that they had a timeshare just means that they got schnookered because those things can't really be resold, so they were taken in. So it's not anything that we certainly put any value on. The Kausis are therefore subjected to this inquiry because of their lifestyle choice, whereas if they lived in a little mansion with the first, second, and third mortgage that they couldn't really afford and drove a leased Lexus, they would pass this means test with flying colors. By being irresponsible, they pass, and by being responsible and trying to pay their debts until it gets so bad that they have to consider a bankruptcy filing, then they're the ones that are being subjected to all of this. So that's on the fairness issue. On the issue of whether or not there are phantom expenses, with the way Congress wrote this law, you know, there's these car title loan places on every street corner, and they'll give you a 700% interest loan on anything. Debtors are almost incentivized to go borrow the money to hire bankruptcy counsel by putting a lien on a vehicle that otherwise would be unencumbered, because then they get this allowance, whereas otherwise they may not. So it's a silly phrasing of the law. We blame Congress, too. But the effect of it is that if you're not allowed a deduction unless you have a car payment, then go get a car payment. They're available on almost every street corner. On the meaning of the word applicable, I want to get back into that just a little bit here. That word is a multi-purpose word. It's referring to the food expenses. It's referring to the transportation operating expenses. It's not just looking at zero, one, or two cars. It's looking at what region of the country do you live in terms of the operating expenses. It's looking at the family size in terms of the food and clothing expenses. It's a multifunctional word, and it doesn't make sense if you take it out in terms of all those other statutes. I mean, they've got a clever reading where they are trying to urge that in looking at cars alone, you can read it the same way as I urge without that word in there. But the word is applied to the whole statute, and we have to select from all these various categories in the IRS code. So that's the gist of my argument. Unless there are any questions, we can cut it short now.
Okay, I guess not. Thank you, Mr. Goyke, and thank you, Mr. Sutko. And the case is taken under advisement.